Rise to Rebellion, Disc 5.
Chapter 10. Franklin. London, December 1772. He marched with precise steps, counted to himself, 1, 2, 3, 4, turned sharply to the right, 3 more steps, turned again, 4 more, then 3, back to the starting point. He did not stop, said aloud, 1, and repeated the routine, moving with a rhythmic pace, the steps taking him to each corner of the room, the sharp right turn at each wall. He was feeling the energy now, picked up the speed, counted aloud each time the circuit was complete, felt the floorboards bouncing slightly beneath him. He began to notice the looser boards, telltale squeaks as his heavy foot landed precisely on the same spot each time around. The sounds added to the routine one more part of the rhythm. He began to breathe more heavily now, couldn't help but smile. Yes, it's working. He felt his mind wandering, fixed a brief gaze on the window, the heavy rain dark and dreary, turned past it, then back around, focused now, his mind scrambling back to the count. Let's see, 7. He could feel the sweat coming, thought, good, good, yes, this is working better than I had predicted. 9. He did not hear the knock at the door at first, but the sound distracted him, and now her voice broke the rhythm, muffled behind the door. "Dr. Franklin, what in God's name are you doing?" He didn't want to stop, his legs moving by themselves. "Not now, Mrs. Stevenson. 12. I'm indisposed." "You had better be indisposed in a decent manner, because I will see what it is you are doing to my house." The door opened slightly, and he passed quickly, nodded, smiling. 14. Good morning, madam." She slipped into the room, and he motioned to the center of the floor. "There, careful, watch yourself. 15. She looked at the furniture, all pushed together, away from the walls, his way clear for the circuit around the room. 16. What may I do for you, Mrs. Stevenson? "You may tell me what in God's name you are doing to my house. The very walls are shaking." 17. "I'm making my visit to Lord and Lady Barwell." 18. She stared at him.
"Barwell?"
"Yes, 19. I had planned on visiting there this morning, making the journey part of my usual exercise. 20. Because of the unfortunate turn in the weather, I thought it best to postpone the visit. However, being that I had 21 counted my paces to their home the last visit, I can approximate the distance. 22, to be roughly 469 circuits of the dimensions of this room. 23. She sat now, cast her eyes down, and he glanced at her as he moved past, saw her shaking slightly. "Dear me, 24. Are you all right?" She looked up, put her hands on her face, and he moved past again, felt concern. 25. Are you feeling ill? Is something wrong? She leaned back in the chair, her face turned toward the ceiling, her hand across her mouth, her eyes fixed on him as he moved by. 26. He suddenly stopped, leaned close to her, and now he could see she was laughing. The sound was faint, held in by her hand, but the small sounds became louder, and her small frame shook. He began to walk again, slowly, the rhythm destroyed, looking at her as he rounded the room. She watched him now, tears on her face, a bright smile, something he had rarely seen. He reached the starting point, his reflex telling him to count the number erased, and she said,
27, doctor.
Yes, 27. He tried to pick up the pace, resumed the routine, could not take his eyes away from her, saw her shake her head slowly, and she pointed at the corner as he passed. He nodded. Yes, I know, 28. She got up now, waited for him to move past the door, stepped quickly across his path, paused in the doorway.
You know, if you continue to move in the same way, you may become dizzy.
It had not occurred to him. And he took a quick survey in his mind, his eyes darting around the room. Not to worry, Mrs. Stevenson, 29. Once halfway there, I shall reverse my course, keep all things in balance. She backed out of the doorway with one final comment.
If the floor should collapse beneath you, I expect you to pay the bill.
She laughed again, closed the door. He strode past, the rhythm returning, found each noisy floorboard,
the routine complete, focused his mind on the count. Her face was still in his mind, the marvelous sound of her laughter, and he could not help but smile. Mrs. Stevenson had gone to the country, a visit to her daughter, and for a full week the house was strangely empty. He had kept up his routine, but the exercise, his attention to the newspapers, did not hide her absence. When she departed, he had proudly announced his intention to fend for himself. But the quiet of the house had unnerved him. She had left him plenty of food, loaves of bread, biscuits, but he had insisted that anything beyond that, meat, vegetables, he would prepare himself. In only 2 days, the food she had provided was gone. The table was set with her finest pewter, plates and flatware, and he pretended not to watch as Strawn began to unpack his basket.
"Quite a feast here, Ben. You sure you won't share? More than I can eat, for certain."
Franklin shrugged.
"No, you go right ahead. This mutton will do quite nicely. Been a while since I roasted a good cut of meat."
He motioned to the low flame in the open hearth.
"Right on the fire, right there, just like our ancestors."
Strawn sat, spread his own meal out on the table, and Franklin could see a bowl of green beans, fat rolls, a small jar of dark red jam. Strawn began to unwrap a linen cloth from a large bundle, and the smell began to drift through the room.
"Beef ribs, my good man. None finer. Horseradish as well."
Franklin felt his stomach twitch, swallowed hard.
"Don't eat beef much, you know. Makes my back itch."
Strawn spread the ribs on his plate.
"Have you told me that before? I recall seeing you eat beef many times." "Yes, quite right, but always I had my ivory-tipped back-scratcher close at hand. Seems the cat has done away with the ivory. All I have now is a stick."
"Pity," Strawn smiled, spooned a dollop of jam on one of the rolls. Franklin looked at his own plate now, stared at the flat white bone, the blade of the lamb roast. He turned it over, poked his finger into a hard black crust, the remains of charred meat crumbling off the bone. He heard sounds from Strawn now, a mumble of pleasure, Strawn's mouth stuffed with his own dinner. Franklin tried to ignore him, stabbed at the lamb with his fork, but there was barely any meat on the bone. He set the fork aside.
"I will have a word with that butcher. Mrs. Stevenson claims he's an honest man, the best cuts of meat, all of that, but when I went to make this purchase, clearly he recognizes an opportunity to take advantage of the unwary. This roast is a bit sparse."
Strawn leaned out over the table, examined Franklin's plate.
"It's more than sparse. It's naked."
Franklin looked toward the fire, studied the thick layer of ashes.
"It is possible I burned away its clothes. I was occupied with other work."
He paused.
"It would be convenient if Mrs. Stevenson were to return a day or two early."
Strawn divided his meal, pushed a plate toward him, and Franklin looked at his friend.
"Pity accepted."
They ate quietly, and Franklin poured from a wine bottle, refilled Strawn's glass as well.
"What work?" Strawn inquired after a moment.
Franklin tasted the wine.
"Well, certainly the change of command, so to speak. I can't imagine the news caught you by surprise."
"Hillsborough?" Strawn sniffed.
"Hardly. He was a man with an enormous talent for making himself unpopular. The king had heard enough, I believe. The word was all over. It was only a matter of time. You have any particular opinion of his successor, Lord Dartmouth?"
Franklin shrugged. "There's a college in New Hampshire. Started out as a school for Indians. He put up some of the funding, and they named it after him. He's a reasonable fellow, I've heard, not nearly as disagreeable as Hillsborough. Whether he has the ability to defuse all the difficulties between England and the colonies is to be seen. As far as I know, his most legitimate claim to the post is that he is the stepbrother of the Prime Minister, Lord North."
Franklin smiled, but there was little humour in his words. "Another example, if you will, of the English way."
Strawn ignored the comment, raised his wine glass, suddenly held it away from him, stared into the red liquid.
"Oh, dear Lord, there's a bug in the wine."
He put the glass on the table, seemed to shiver slightly, and Franklin reached for the glass, tilted it toward him.
A fly. I wouldn't be concerned. They don't seem to eat living things.
He reached into his pocket, pulled out a white handkerchief, spread it on the table.
With your permission, may I retrieve the fly?
Of course. Why?
An experiment. I've seen this before. Let's see if it will work again.
He put a finger into the glass, retrieved the fly, carefully set the fly on the handkerchief.
Now let's see if he revives.
Strawn looked at him intently.
You mean he's not dead? He certainly looks dead to me. Forgive me, Ben, but it's rather disgusting.
Franklin carefully prodded the fly.
Never known you to be so squeamish, Will. But there is a point to be made here. This is a creature of God, no less than you or me. And God supposedly looks out for all his creatures.
The fly suddenly made a buzzing sound, rolled about on the handkerchief, and Franklin sat back.
Ha! Observe! The little fellow will shortly regain his composure.
The two men stared at the fly, and the buzzing stopped, then began again, and suddenly the fly was gone, disappearing into the dull light of the room. Franklin sat back, satisfied.
See? Told you I've observed that before.
Strawn looked at the wine bottle.
I'm not sure just what it means, Ben. Was the fly dead?
Oh, I believe he was. But he was somehow preserved in the wine, held in some state that would allow his rebirth. I don't pretend to understand it, but it has caused me to study the properties of the wine. Can you imagine?
He felt the enthusiasm growing inside him, the joy of the successful experiment.
What do you suppose would happen if we tried this with a man?
Strawn stared with wide eyes.
You mean drown a man in wine?
No, no, not drown so much.
Well, yes, that's one way to describe it. A man is suffering from a terrible affliction, smallpox perhaps, his demise imminent. With his consent, of course, you immerse him in a vat of wine, allow him to come to rest, and seal the vat. At some future time, with advancements in medical science, there might be a cure for his ailment. At that time, perhaps, like the fly, he could be revived.
Strawn's mouth was slightly open.
Assuming you are serious, and I know you well enough never to take that for granted, how long do you think a man could last in the wine? How much time could elapse before a successful revivification?
Franklin shrugged, reached for the wine bottle, filled his glass.
I have no idea. There could be some basic difference between the fly and the man that would prevent it from working at all. And I suppose at some point time could become a factor. Leave the man in the vat long enough, he becomes a pickle.
Strawn blinked at him, a look of skepticism.
Well, if I should fall prey to some illness, I would request you not attempt this experiment on me. I am quite content to go when my time has arrived.
Franklin sipped the wine, stared at the lamplight.
Keep an open mind, Will. All great scientific breakthroughs begin as simply as finding a fly in your wine bottle.
Strawn eyed his wine glass, but did not lift it.
You going to waste a good glass of Madeira? Waste not, want not.
Strawn reached for the glass, a small hesitation, then suddenly downed the entire glass. He stretched his hand out for the bottle again.
I believe we were talking about your work. Any other experiments taking place here besides your flirtation with the laws of nature?
A number of projects. I have considered undertaking the writing of an autobiography.
Autobiography?
Yes. I know, it's considered terribly vain to tell your own tales and all of that, but a concern for vanity has never stopped me from doing anything. I thought it might perhaps be useful to relate my own experiences, pass along the lessons of a long life. It's quite likely that if I don't do it, no one else will either.
I can sell it, no doubt. There's an audience for something like this.
Here or in America?
Strawn laughed, took a sip of wine.
America first, but you do pique some interest in England. I thought I would address it to William, shape it in the form of a letter to him, the tales of a father passed to his son. It may be the only way.
He stopped, and there was a quiet moment.
He's still your son, Strawn said.
And you are still my friend, Will. But the world is pulling us in all directions.
Politics is a poison. Loyalties are being tested. My son cannot speak openly to me any more than I can speak openly to you.
We serve our own masters, Ben. But the job is separate from the man. You work for the colonies. Your son and I work for King George. That doesn't change who we are, how well we know each other. It doesn't change our friendship.
Franklin put a piece of bread in his mouth, thought, "You may be very wrong about that. Whether you believe it or not, there are lines being drawn. And as the lines become deeper, the distance between us becomes wider." He sipped the wine.
"I have considered renewing my petition to Parliament."
"Which one?"
There was humor in Strawn's voice, but Franklin did not smile.
"The colony of Massachusetts supports my request that Parliament and the King's Ministry allow representation from the colonies themselves. If we have a voice in those proceedings, if the colonies can send their own elected members, it will solve..."
"Ben, not again. You went through this a few years ago. Where did it get you? It's a closed door, especially now, with Lord Dartmouth new to his position. This could embarrass him, plant him in the center of a controversy he doesn't deserve. The colonies will just have to be satisfied with virtual representation, the same as the rest of the empire. It's a system that works, Ben, despite what anyone in Boston has to say."
The words dug into him. Virtual representation. It was the excuse, the dusty explanation unearthed each time anyone really examined the way Parliament was elected. He moved a fork around on his plate. "One day, that doctrine will rise up to bite this government pretty hard."
"Ben, I don't want to argue this with you now." "I won't argue with you, Will. I'm not telling you that Parliament or the King should change anything.
But you had better recognize that there are an awful lot of people right here in England who have no say in their government. Parliament is elected by, what, 3% of your people? There are towns that are not represented at all, no membership. There are other places with barely a breathing population who have a dozen seated members. It's a corrupt system, Will."
"I've heard all of this, Ben, but it's the only system we have. The ultimate power still rests with the King. He will not allow any of your so-called corruption to injure this empire. He has our best interests at heart, yours too. Parliament is a tool, one piece of the machine. How the members are elected, how any one man reaches his seat there, is of little importance. The whole body represents every part of the empire. Every subject of the King is virtually represented there, whether he votes or not, whether a citizen of every town sits there or not, whether or not a colony sends its own man. The Parliament's function is to govern, and governing means representing the whole."
Franklin pushed his chair back, felt a weariness, the dinner stirring in his gut. He stood slowly, moved toward the hearth, felt the warmth on his hands. "It's a chasm," he thought, "an irreconcilable difference. They accept the corruption in their system because it's too deeply implanted. They populate their government with the first men who can buy their seat or who can grovel most effectively to the King. And across the Atlantic is a healthy, vibrant community that accepts nothing of the sort, that has a voice and a heart and a collective mind that will not tolerate the stale explanations." He turned now, looked at Strawn. "There is no spirit here, Will. The Empire is an ailing old man, empty of energy, of hope, of a future. What you do not understand is that America cannot suffer to live under the dominance of your decay. And the more they resist, the more they will be made to suffer for it. You govern the colonies by sending men over there who make their reputation by the loudness of their quarrels. The more controversy the governors achieve, the more the King applauds their loyalty. The division between England and America is now taken for granted. It is a fact of life. The more dissatisfied the colonies become, the more oppressive the King must be in response. The more oppression, the more dissatisfaction. How must this conclude?"
"I think you oversimplify, Ben. The king does not want open conflict with America. What is to be gained?
Franklin turned back to the fire, and the word rolled through his mind. Independence. But I cannot say that to him. I cannot say it to anyone here. Any suggestion of revolution is treasonous.
You're right, Will. There is little to be gained from any of this. What good comes from talk? What can one man do, after all?
Strawn rose from the table, moved to the small cabinet across the room, pulled out a dark, heavy bottle.
I know where you hide the port, Ben. Join me.
Franklin moved away from the hearth, took the small glass from Strawn's hand. Strawn motioned to the chair.
Sit down, Ben. Relax. You'll feel better once Mrs. Stevenson comes home. Good meals put you in a better frame of mind.
Franklin sat, stared silently at the dark red liquid in the glass.
I love this place, I truly do. But I am not one of them. As long as change is so odious to these people, as long as they do not recognize that the world beyond the shores of this island is moving away faster than they can comprehend, then change will only come from one direction, from outside. I had so hoped they could be made to see, to recognize that the old ways cannot simply be imposed on everyone, that you cannot bludgeon the restless spirit out of an entire country, and not pay a price. We just don't know what the price will be. Not yet.
Strawn held up the glass, said,
A toast. To one man's overwrought worrying.
Strawn laughed, and Franklin tapped their glasses together, said nothing. His friend leaned forward, scolding him.
Oh, come now, Ben, you said it yourself. One man's efforts are of little use in changing this world.
Franklin looked toward the fire.
That, Will, is the difference between us. You place no value on the efforts of one man.
He had seen the man's carriage stop, had rushed downstairs, waited by the door for the knock. Now he opened the door, looked at the man's fear, the eyes darting around, the head turning out toward the street. Franklin said, Come in, it's all right. The man reached inside his coat, pulled out the small parcel.
No, I'll be going now. Here, this is what you wanted.
Franklin took the parcel, reached into his pocket, retrieved a small leather pouch, handed it to the man. The pouch vanished quickly, and just as quickly the man was gone, the carriage rattling away down the street. He closed the door, climbed the stairway, moved into his room, shutting the door behind him. He unwrapped the parcel, felt the paper, ran his thumb along the edge of the stack of letters. He looked up toward the window now, the weather clear and breezy, blue sky, excellent, good sailing weather. These should find Boston before the spring. He spread the letters out on the small table, shifted them around, held one up, read the name on the cover page, Honorable Thomas Hutchinson, Governor. Slid his finger under the wax seal, already broken, the paper worn, creased. He opened the letter, read, felt his heart beating in his chest, the words filling his mind, the anger now rushing through him. Yes, by damned, here it is. Plainly and directly, your arrogance, your disdain. Now we will expose the very heart of our troubles. One man's efforts, indeed. Chapter 11. Adams. Boston, March 1773. On this occasion I think fit to acquaint you that there has lately fallen into my hands part of a correspondence that I have reason to believe laid the foundation of most, if not all, of our present grievances. Adams read silently, then saw the signature, Benjamin Franklin. put the letter down, looked around the room. The men were all staring at him as he read Franklin's letter. Then he handed the letter to Warren, who said, "Dr. Franklin has sent us 18 letters altogether. 6 are directly from the hand of Governor Hutchinson. As you can see, the others are from Lieutenant Governor Oliver and 2 other quite prominent members of our most wise ruling class. I make no apology for sarcasm. I would request that each of you read them and pass them along." The letters were passed around the room, and Adams read a few, thought, "There is little here of any real interest. I'm not sure I understand what all the drama is about. Dr. Franklin's concerns seem a bit exaggerated." He began to read another, glanced down at the signature, Hutchinson's familiar penstroke, scanned the words, his mind coming to sharp focus now. There must be an abridgment of what are called English liberties. Adams lowered the paper, looked at Sam, who was watching him carefully. "My God, is he insane? Read it all, John." Adams studied the words again, and now the room seemed to come alive, the voices rising together. Warren raised his hands. "Gentlemen, please, there is much to discuss here. Dr. Franklin has given our cause an extraordinary gift. It is up to us to make a prudent decision how it can be used." Adams handed the letter to Warren, who gathered them all into a bundle. He looked at Sam now, his cousin's expression distant, his mind working furiously. Adams waited for a lull in the discussions, said, "The governor apparently believes that his office should no longer receive any input from the elected assemblies. Here, in this one, he actually insists that the governor should be independent." "It's much more than that, John." Warren put a finger on the bundle. "It's pretty plain here that what Hutchinson and all these other men believe is that there is only one solution to the disputes between the colonies and England. Recall Hutchinson's words, 'a firmer hand.' That means one thing when a parent refers to the discipline of a child. It means something altogether different when one country seeks to dominate another. For all the talk, the patronizing attention he gives our concerns, here in his own words he reveals what he truly believes. If we disagree with the king's policies, we should be put down by force." Adams looked around the room. "If I may ask, how exactly did we come by these letters?" Warren replied, "They were received by Tom Cushing. He is a friend of Dr. Franklin's and close to many in this room. Since he is Speaker of the Assembly and Franklin considers him a reliable friend, who would be more appropriate? I do believe that Franklin has placed himself in a somewhat vulnerable position. If word should spread in London that we have possession of these letters through his hand, he may well be arrested. He was quite specific to Cushing that these letters not be published, copied, or distributed carelessly. He also requested that eventually they be returned to him." Sam reached out, took the bundle, turned it over in his hand. "I'm sorry for Dr. Franklin, but his request is not terribly realistic. The comments made in these letters are more than just indiscreet musings for our entertainment. For years we have assumed that the policies of the ministry have come from the ministry. We have assumed that our struggle to protect our liberties has been with England. I am somewhat embarrassed that I did not think of this before. Consider this, gentlemen. They are 3,000 miles away. Their information, all they know about what is happening here, comes from dispatches and letters, newspaper reports and pamphlets. We are all aware of the questionable reliability of some of that." There was low laughter, and Sam put the letters down, leaned forward, his arms on his knees. "We have been fools, gentlemen. The ministry, Parliament, the King, they don't make their decisions blindly. They receive advice from the one source whose job it is to provide that advice. It is not Englishmen who create the threat. It is Americans. Thomas Hutchinson, a Harvard man, the good Bostonian. If there is to be a British army marching through our homes, it is because Thomas Hutchinson believes it is the right course of action." Warren rose, moved around behind his chair, said, "It is one thing to be an arm of the king, to represent the king's interests, to be sure we follow official policy, obey the king's laws. It is quite another matter when a governor and his accomplices advise the king to do away with the law. Mr. Adams,
You seem to understand that more than anyone."
Adams nodded, with a glance at the bundle of letters. "Certainly, but I am somewhat troubled that we may be opening ourselves up to censure. These are private letters. Dr. Franklin may be quite right in his concerns. Is there no right of privacy that protects the governor from this kind of invasion?"
"Cousin John, I admire your uncanny talent for serving as our collective conscience. You are certainly aware that there are often several definitions of the same law, more than one interpretation of the same event. These letters were written by public officials, men who serve their colony in an official capacity. I don't believe that anything they do or say or write is entirely their own business."
Warren leaned close to Adams. "John, Dr. Franklin has written to me more than once of his certainty that his mail is opened and examined by someone in London. It has simply become a fact of life. For a time he assumed it to be Lord Hillsborough or some of his people. The point is that both sides are doing whatever they can, legal, moral, or otherwise, to keep a close eye on the other."
"Is that how we think now? We are two sides?"
"John, you are an optimist. Despite all that has happened, you still want to believe that reason will prevail. Look at these letters again. What reason is here? Our own governor, our valuable connection to the king, is betraying us."
Warren looked at Sam.
"What do you think we should do with these?"
Sam shook his head.
"There is no such thing as absolute secrecy, not anymore.
As much as I respect the possible consequences to Ben Franklin, the contents of these letters are too important to keep sealed inside this room. Hutchinson's words are plainly and simply incendiary. This is a spark that could bring the people out of their complacency. I propose that these letters be read before the Assembly. Public record. Let everyone know how the mind of their beloved governor works."
"What of Dr. Franklin?" protested Adams.
"There's little anyone can do to protect him here. Is he to become a sacrifice?"
Sam glanced up at Warren, who said, "Franklin is a wise man. I believe he understands the risks he has taken. And he certainly has influence in London with people who can help protect him. This serves him quite well, you know. There has always been some speculation in Massachusetts about his divided loyalties. No longer."
Sam looked slowly at each man in the room.
"Does anyone object to the public release of these letters?"
Adams saw heads shaking. He turned to Sam now, said in a low voice, "No." Sam picked up the bundle, stood.
"We will make copies, distribute them to the papers. In a week's time, Governor Hutchinson will have discovered that his arrogance, his blithe disregard, his very contempt for the citizens he is supposed to govern, will be unmasked once and for all. We are one step closer, gentlemen. We have identified the enemy."
Braintree, April 1773. She'd prepared a huge breakfast, great mounds of flat cakes, fat links of sausage, bread, butter, syrups, and jellies. He pushed back from the table with a low moan, and she couldn't hide a smile.
"Did you get enough to eat? We have some bacon still."
He put a hand on his stomach.
"So may I now expect you to tease me about my eating habits? This feast was your doing, I believe."
She rose, began to clear away the dishes.
"You are innocent of the charges, Mr. Adams. The guilt is assigned to your wife. Overindulgence of cookery. What's my punishment?"
He rose, still feeling the roundness at his belt, watched as she finished clearing the table. "No punishment. Conviction overturned, Mistress Abigail. Appears the evidence has vanished, or at least it's been well hidden under my coat." The sounds of the children spilled over from the next room, but not what he expected, nothing of the infant. They now had a fourth child, Thomas, born the preceding September, yet another responsibility for Abigail to manage in his absence. His eldest son suddenly burst in, crawled up on a chair.
"Papa, are you all done? Can we go out to the hill, the big hill? I saw a fox."
Adams looked at the boy, saw the bright excitement, a tumble of words welling up inside the five-year-old. He looked at Abigail, asked, "Where did he see a fox? What hill? Has this boy been allowed to run off by himself?" Abigail still held the dish towel in her hand. She put it down on the table.
Do you suppose we all just sit here by the fireplace and wait for you to come home? The children and I take a good long stroll around the farm whenever the weather allows. We were up behind the orchard above the creek. We saw a fox. The boy crawled off the chair, moved to Adam's side, pulled on his coat. Can we go back? Come on, Papa. Abigail slid around the table, took the boy's hand. Not now, John Quincy. We'll go later. But I want Papa to come. See the fox. She eased the boy away, said quietly, Yes, we will. Later. Come now. Adams watched them disappear into the next room. Soon Abigail returned, shaking her head. The mother doesn't count for much when it comes to affairs of nature, big game hunting and all. He wants his father to handle all the dangerous things. She laughed and picked up the towel. He just watched her, felt a strange gloom, and she said, I was teasing, John. No, it is hardly a tease. I don't do those things with him. I'm so often gone. She moved around the table again, close to him. No one blames you. I know you would rather be here, but your work is too important. It means too much. He glanced toward the other room, could hear the voices of the children, and said, Could we go outside? She knew the mood, made no protest, followed him to the front door, took his arm as the sunlight flooded the room. They moved out into the front yard, and quickly the two older children were there with delighted shouts. All right, you two, Abigail told them. Leave us be for a time. Nabby, you look in on the babies. John Quincy, you find something else to do. There were small protests, but the children stayed behind. She held his arm tightly. They are so fortunate to have this place. I wonder sometimes how much different it would be for them if they had only the city. He began to walk slowly, Abigail close behind him. He led her past the corner of the house, stopped, stared up the long rise, the fields clean and brown. They are fortunate indeed. I've never doubted that. All my life, this was the most important place. It's all I ever really wanted. She looked at him, curious. What's wrong, John? He moved apart from her, stepped close to the edge of the empty field, his hands resting on his hips. She followed, stopped close beside him again. It's happening, faster than I ever imagined. She said nothing, knew his words would come. I am proud of my profession, my practice. I suppose I have as much ambition as anyone else. I always wanted to be successful. I try to understand what drives other men, how their ambition is different from mine. Sam has a great need, a fire he cannot control. Men like Warren, Josiah Quincy, John Hancock, I never really understood what so inflames their fury, their passion for a fight against England. I have no quarrel living under the rule of the king. He's a good man, I think. He cares for his subjects. Wants what is best for the empire. We have come such a long way since one man could simply have his way with his people, all the horror that seems to come from absolute power. But it is so much more complicated than that. The same way my life is so much more complicated than just enjoying my farm and my law practice. It's all connected. This place and Boston, Warren and Hutchinson, Sam and King George. Everything is changing. You can't hide from it. I can't just walk out into these fields and plant my seeds, play with the children, and pretend I'm merely a simple lawyer getting by in a simple world. Nothing is simple anymore. He bent down, scooped up a handful of dirt, sifted it through his fingers. I've always appreciated that the law is so different from farming, so much more intangible. Here, it's dirt and seeds and plants, the children, you. In Boston, it's words, principles, ideas. If anyone should have understood what is happening to America, it should have been me. It's easy to confront soldiers marching by your house or a ship like the Gaspee. It's tangible, real, something you can attack.
it's much harder to attack an idea. To understand that there is a threat to something you can't touch. I haven't been paying attention. I've been too absorbed in my own ambition to understand how serious things have become. She touched his arm.
But you saw it for yourself when the king took the judges away. You spoke out. I was so proud of you then.
It wasn't enough. I was angry because suddenly there was an assault on me, my interests. It was selfish. And for all that anger, nothing changed. The king didn't listen to me. Hutchinson didn't listen to me. Sam did much more than anyone else. His idea about the committees of correspondence gave a voice to every town, no matter how small. All over Massachusetts, the people began to speak, town meetings, opening up communication with every part of the colony. It spread to the other colonies, too, Virginia, Pennsylvania. He rallied the people, showed them that if they don't speak out now, they may never be allowed to speak at all. I don't know why it has taken me so long to understand what is going to happen.
What do you mean?
Unless there is some radical change, unless some miracle brings these politicians to their senses, there will be a revolution. Sam has been talking about that for years. I thought he was a little insane. But he was only premature. And he was right. It's inevitable. There is no negotiation, no compromise, no reasoning. There are no rules. A lawyer looks for order, for rational, legal explanations, solutions to every problem based on law and logic and wisdom. But none of that is working now.
Surely not everyone feels this way. I always thought your cousin was trying too hard, creating the turmoil, not responding to it.
He was surprised, said, "You've been paying better attention to all this than I have. Sam has been accused of a great deal, no doubt of that, but I'm closer to it now. I see what is happening. One by one, people I thought were removed from all this, the clear thinkers, are talking the same way, sounding the same theme. A year ago, hardly anyone would even have thought of using the word independence. Now everyone is using it. Even those most loyal to the king understand that something monumental is happening." There was silence now, the soft whisper of breeze. Abigail pulled up close to him, a slight shiver. He clamped his arm tight on hers. "I'm sorry. I should be here. My son is growing up. One day I'll come home and he'll have a musket over one shoulder and be dragging in a deer." She laughed.
"Not just yet. He'll wait for you to show him how. He wants to do everything like you. When you're not here, he talks about being a lawyer. He doesn't even know what it means. But if you do it, he wants to do it."
"Then I had better give him something to be proud of." Chapter 12. Gage. The North Atlantic, June 1773. Her name was the Earl of Dunmore, commanded by a stern, crusty man named Effingham Lawrence. The ship had sailed from New York Harbor on June 8, and if the weather was not difficult and the currents were steady, they would reach England in a month's time. Gage had planned the trip for several months, had begun to feel a restlessness not just with his command, but with the colonies in general. It went beyond simply missing the children sent home to school, beyond the obvious social airs that separated London from New York. Margaret's only experience beyond the borders of America was the difficult time they had endured in Canada, and he tried to nurture a curiosity in her, telling her stories of his youth, describing the English countryside with as much romance as he could muster. It was a struggle at best, and she had fought him in that awful, silent way that wives know. He still could not understand her attachment to America, how any woman who was so fortunate to have the opportunity to travel to England would protest of all she was leaving behind. After days of silence,
She had finally agreed to take the trip, as much to see the children as for any curiosity about gardens and green hills and meeting her in-laws. His restless urge to leave New York had much to do with a growing frustration he was feeling toward his superiors in London. Since the Gaspé incident, there had been no policy coming out of England at all, no direction, no specific instructions for him on how to prepare for the conflicts that were certain to return. Lord Hillsborough was vocal and direct with his disdain for the rowdy behavior of the Americans, and Gage had always felt that Hillsborough shared his enthusiasm for a hard strike at the rebellious spirit. But if Hillsborough never said it to Gage, Gage believed that Hillsborough was held back by timidity in the ministry, the unwillingness of some to actually make a strong stand against the radical voices in Boston. The lack of conviction infuriated Gage, and now that Hillsborough was gone, replaced by a man who did not seem to share the hard-line attitude, the fading opportunity for Gage to exercise his troops at the expense of the rabble had made him question whether his position in the colonies held any future for him after all. The farewell to New York had been dramatic and boisterous. There had been parties, the society women fawning over Margaret with poorly hidden jealousy for her visit to England, the source of everything civilized. Margaret had made the good show, allowed all the cooing to flow over her, the polite enthusiasm for the great adventure. Gage had been surprised at the outpouring from friends, long-winded toasts, firm handshakes from men with tears in their eyes. The salutes had been official as well, the city of New York sponsoring a lavish dinner, complete with gifts and the strange offering of ceremonial keys to the city. There had been only silence from the Sons of Liberty, and Gage wanted to believe that to many of the rabble, those who stirred their unlawful rebellion, his absence was a relief. But the army would not be without a commander. In his place, Sir Frederick Haldimand would transfer up from the southern headquarters at Pensacola. Gage had made the choice himself, knew the Swiss-born Haldimand was both a good soldier and a no-nonsense officer. If the protesters believed they could make noise in Gage's absence, Haldimand would be the man to disappoint them. For weeks before the Earl of Dunmore sailed, Gage had found himself daydreaming about the adventure of it, the journey on the great ship, then beyond, London, the old homestead, his brother, the children. He had no real idea how long he would stay, and it was a topic he avoided with Margaret. He knew that she expected to return as quickly as his official business would allow. But the surprising show of emotion from his friends told him that many did not expect him to return at all. The sea had been calm for the most part, a steady westerly wind pushing the Earl of Dunmore smoothly over the rolling swells. Through the long, quiet nights, the ship rocked in a peaceful rhythm that helped keep the stomachs of even the most uninitiated travelers at rest. The day had come as most had come, bright and blue and glorious. He stood beside Margaret's young brother, his aide, Major Kemble. Kemble was leaning out, staring down into the froth below them, and Gage said, "A bit of decorum, Mr. Kemble. There's enough of a competitive spirit between soldiers and sailors as it is. No need to demonstrate to them an unbridled show of curiosity." Kemble pulled himself back, seemed disappointed. "Yes, sir, quite." He lowered his voice now, added, "But I've seen fish, actually. Big ones, too." Gage glanced behind him. "I'm quite certain these sailors are considerably entertained by the gleeful sense of wonder shown by their passengers, but we are soldiers, Mr. Kemble, need I remind you?" Kemble was chastened now, nodded. "Yes, sir. Won't happen again." Kemble moved away, and Gage waited a long moment, then moved close to the railing again, peered out slightly. "Big fish?" He heard the voice of Captain Lawrence. "5 degrees to starboard. Tighten her up." Gage straightened quickly, looked around, saw the captain's lean figure, the man always on watch, always prowling the deck. Gage had tried to strike up some conversation with the rugged commander, but Lawrence seemed to be a man of few words. Gage watched him, thinking, "He has that same arrogance I've seen in so many of the Navy men. I'm simply a foot soldier, and no matter my rank or position, out here I'm just another passenger. If it was me, if this was my ship, I'd probably behave the same way. This is more than his home, his job. It's his wife, his friend, his life. I'm not sure why any man does this, leaves the land. It's dangerous, unpredictable. You can't hold tight to command out here. In the end, you're not really in charge of anything." Lawrence was beside him now, looking out over the railing, and Gage said nothing, waited for the opening, saw Lawrence staring down into the deep blue water. Lawrence was silent, and Gage thought, "He's not looking at fish. He seems to be praying." Gage suddenly backed away from the railing, felt like an intruder. He had tried to guess the man's age, deep creases in his face, grey hair visible beneath the edge of his hat. The voice was hoarse from years of shouting commands, absorbing the hard weather on the high seas. So many of the ship captains were powdered gentlemen, men of title, of family, a long history of sailing in their lineage. He thought of many he had met, frail, pompous men, who came to the sea because they were supposed to, commanding by some supposed aura, the captain maintaining his perch like some glorious bird. And they probably never get their hands dirty. Not this one, though. There's nothing that happens on this ship that he doesn't control. Lawrence pulled himself back, looked at Gage.
"Morning, General. We'll be reaching port today. The lookouts can see the coastline now."
Lawrence caught Gage looking past him toward the railing.
"You have your rituals, General. Last day at sea, I offer a little word of thanks. She was kind to us this trip. It's best we remember how many good men rowed their ships to the bottom."
Lawrence strode away toward the bow, his crewmen standing aside as he passed. Gage went to the railing again, stared at the horizon, could see it now, the smooth line broken by a long, low mound. He thought of Margaret, knew she was down in their quarters. Once they had left the prying eyes and talkative gossips of New York, she had grown sullen again, had rarely come up on deck. He had given up trying to bring her alive, to give her some reason why she should be enjoying this experience, not regarding it as a journey into the depths of hell. But he knew the door was closed, his efforts exhausted. He told himself, "She is probably sleeping now. Best just leave her alone. But I do wish she could see this. That coastline. England." Margaret stayed below deck until the ship reached the wharf, would not join in the mass of passengers along the rails as the ship slid slowly into the harbor. There was excitement in all of them, businessmen mostly, families as well, watching with him as the great ship was pulled in tight to the wharf, secured by long, fat ropes. The other passengers had treated him with respect, even distance, and Gage had been grateful there had not been too many indiscreet questions about Margaret. No one else knew of her silent protest of this voyage, and he had been rescued from his embarrassment by her obvious pregnancy. She had rarely had difficulty with childbirth, and this child would be their seventh. Despite the arched eyebrows of many of the women in New York, and of some of the bolder passengers, Gage had shown no concern that her condition might be made difficult by the voyage. It was an arrogant dismissal of the dangers of weather and sea, but as the ship had rolled closer to England, even the most squeamish admitted that this trip had been as gentle and pleasant as any they had experienced, their arrival in Portsmouth less than a month after leaving New York. He had wanted to be the first to disembark from the ship, to make some ceremony of his long-awaited stroll onto English soil. It had begun to obsess him, and he was prepared to make a formal request to Captain Lawrence, the words chosen carefully, rehearsed, as a senior officer of His Majesty's service. As the last ropes were secured firmly to the wharf, he had stepped into place at the rail, expected to find some competition, had his firm speech prepared. He would not admit it to Margaret, but he had imagined a brass band, some parade, a celebration of welcome, the soldier returning victorious to the land he left behind. But the fantasy soon dissolved. Captain Lawrence, tending to other duties, and Gage felt a small tug of disappointment that no one seemed to care who was in fact the first off the ship. He stepped onto the hard timbers of the wharf, the people crowding behind him, flowing off the ship to the cheers and arms of family and friends. The fantasy had vanished completely now, replaced by the practical, finding transportation, the handling of their luggage. Margaret was beside him now, her mood quiet, but he could tell that curiosity had replaced her sullenness. Kemble was out in front, pointed the way now to a small building, the naval office, moved quickly away, stopping at the door. Gage saw the king's crest prominently displayed, felt a sudden sense of security, satisfaction. No protests here, no ridiculous tolerance for anarchy. Kemble pulled open the door, and Gage allowed Margaret to pass, then stepped inside. The room was dimly lit, the windows choked with dust, windowsills piled high with yellow paper. He blinked, fought the strange, musty smell, saw no one. Kemble stepped forward to a low desk.
"I say, anyone on duty?"
There was a shuffle of sound in a back room, and now a man appeared in the rumpled uniform of a sailor, frowning like a man whose peace has been disturbed.
"Aye, what can I do for you? Major Kemble, I am aide to Lieutenant General Thomas Gage."
The sailor seemed unimpressed.
"And I said, what can I do for you?"
Kemble glanced back at Gage, and Gage saw that his brother-in-law's face had already reddened. Kemble said with a low hiss,
"Is that any way to respond to a superior officer?"
The man scanned Kemble, looked past him, studied Gage's uniform, seemed to see Margaret now for the first time, glimpsed the round protrusion at her middle, made a sudden show of toothy politeness, a short bow.
"Madam."
Gage moved up close behind Kemble, could feel the young man's heat, said,
"It's all right, Major. Excuse me, sailor. Is there an officer on duty?"
The man examined Gage's uniform more closely, eyed the gold epaulets, nodded slowly.
"Very nice indeed, yes, sir. That would be Ensign Phillips."
"Well, then, would you be so kind as to summon Ensign Phillips?"
"I hear my name. Bloody hell, this better be important."
The man came out of the back room, stopped in his tracks, stared at Gage with an open mouth. Gage saw a very young face, bad skin. The man snapped to attention.
"Sir, my apologies, sir. I should not have kept you waiting."
The sailor looked at Phillips with amusement, slowly drew himself up to attention as well, and Phillips said,
"Forgive me, sir, but I do not know you."
Kemble interrupted, seemed relieved by the show of protocol.
"Ensign, this is General and Mrs. Gage. We have just arrived from New York."
Phillips seemed to pale, glanced around the office.
"Oh, my word, please forgive the conditions, General. We do not normally receive senior officers here. They usually have their own arrangements."
Gage said, "I did not expect any arrangements, Ensign. We are en route to London and require transportation." The sailor leaned close to Phillips.
"The stage."
Phillips nodded. "Yes, the stage. Sir, I will show you. If you will follow me, there is a stagecoach for London at the top of the hour."
Phillips moved quickly out from behind the desk, opened the door, made a bow to Margaret.
"If you please, this way."
Gage glanced around the office again, dust on every surface, looked at the sailor now, the man slouching under his own coating of grime, and the man suddenly smiled, said,
"Welcome to England, General."
Gage stared at the man's dirty uniform, the rough beard, the brown teeth, felt a rising tide of disappointment, turned, without speaking, moved out into grey daylight. Kemble was waiting for him, moved away now, matching the nervous paces of the young ensign. Gage looked back toward the ship, saw longshoremen silently unloading cargo, efficiency of motion. He looked up to the railing, saw Captain Lawrence staring down, a stern eye on every man.
"Yes, by all means," he thought. "That's what it takes. It's the difference between this fine crew and that one absurd specimen in that office."
and it's the difference between order and anarchy in the colonies. He picked up his pace now, Margaret watching him, waiting to take his arm. They moved together, following their guide, and his mind drifted away, thoughts of New York and Boston, all the turmoil so insignificant now. That's what all those colonists don't understand. They are so few, so small. They live in their sheltered colonies, so far away from the authority of the king, from the power of real government. He could see more great ships, rows of tall masts lining the wharves, the quick bustle of activity, the trade and commerce of a great empire. It's simple, after all, even simpler than I had believed. He began to think of the meetings, imagined the conversations with the Prime Minister, Lord North, with Lord Dartmouth. He began to find the words, a rousing speech, fiery condemnation of the rebellious rabble, maybe even a speech before Parliament. Yes, of course, I should go there. There will certainly be an invitation, their appreciation for years of good service. It might even be a farewell of sorts, the prelude to a new position here. He was smiling now, looked away, hiding it from Margaret. He was suddenly excited, regretted that he had not been able to give plenty of notice of his arrival. It was all so complicated, Haldimand taking over, the travel plans, Margaret's concerns. Surely they are aware I'm here, or they will be when we reach London. He glanced at Margaret, saw exhaustion on her face, saw Kemba looking back at her as well, a brother's concern. Yes, soon we will settle in with my relatives, at least for a while. She can give birth in a home that welcomes her as one of its own. It's all she needs, all it will take to convince her that this is where she belongs. The excitement continued, a strange clarity in his mind. By God, we are home. The fantasy returned, and he felt himself strutting down the wharf to the sounds of a brass band.
This ends Disc 5.